So tonight I'm going to continue with this series of talks I've given on the paramis, and we're up to number six, which is Kanti, patience. Remember the sequence. These things are very sequential. So we've the first two, Dana and Sila, we got our life in order in the world, and then we started renunciation came, so we started to take the practice seriously. Wisdom started to arise, and then with the fifth parami, we started putting energy and effort into the practice, more energy and effort, because we saw the value of that. And then comes patience. Why is patience here now, right? What's the significance here? Well, here's the story. It's very common when people put a lot of energy into something, when they put, they've followed all the rules, and now I'm putting lots of energy into it. They sort of, they want some results. They want something dramatic to happen. And this practice just doesn't work that way. Oh, darn. Right? It's like our whole culture is based on this idea of instant gratification, right? The expected, you push the right button or have the right gizmo or the right app, and everything you need is at your fingertips whenever you want it. You're told over and over again, you can have it all. And not only can you have it all, you can have it now. That's not how the practice works. It isn't that way at all. Patience isn't just tolerance, which is another thing. It's like, oh, I'll be patient, but patience isn't just tolerance. Putting up with the present until things get better. Patience is the opposite of restlessness, which I spoke of a few weeks ago. Patience is the art of caring slowly. I came across that definition. I really liked it. The art of caring slowly. Of being okay with difficulty and challenge without resistance, without pushing against it. There's a verse from the Dhammapada here that I like. This is verse 184. So remember, the Dhammapada is these pithy sayings of the Buddha, in a sense, somewhat poetic perhaps. Patient endurance, the foremost austerity. Unbinding, the foremost, so say the awakened. He who injures another is not contemplative. He who mistreats another, no monk. But this starts with this line, patient endurance, the foremost austerity. Remember, austerity, in Pali, that the word for that is tapas. And austerity is this idea that somehow or other, if you just sort of grit and bear down and be really fierce, that somehow something's going to happen, right? And remember that the Buddha spent 5 years practicing, these extremely austere practices in the forest with these five other guys. I mean, they were like, they say they were living on nettle soup and 1 grain of rice a day. And, you could look at them from the front and see their spine and where their stomach was. And it was extreme. And then the Buddha said, basically, I mean, the idea was, if we just suffer enough, then we'll understand suffering and then we'll overcome it. And finally, the Buddha said, "No, this doesn't work." And he left the other five guys and went off and started eating and sort of getting some flesh on his bones and eventually settled down under the Bodhi tree and came to enlightenment by what he called the middle way. This is Ajahn Sasito from his book Parami talking about the same idea. The Buddha famously declared Kanti to be the supreme purification practice. He is playing on the Vedic term tapas, which signifies the taking on of an austere or ascetic practice such as fasting or mortifying the body in order to cleanse the mind of passions and attachments. But the Buddha pointed not to the physical asceticism, which he frequently spoke against, but of the restraint of holding the heart still in the presence of its suffering until it lets go of the way in which it creates that suffering. I'll read that sentence again because But the Buddha pointed not to physical asceticism, which he frequently spoke against, but to the restraint of holding the heart still in the presence of suffering until it lets go of the ways in which it creates that suffering. So he's now acknowledging that we create our own suffering. And if we just hold our heart still and let it be, then the suffering ceases. That is the heart mind habitually creates suffering and stress through reacting to, holding on to, or getting caught up with what life throws at us. All the perfections contribute to the lessening or dismantling of that dukkha. But the specific quality of patience is to carry the heart through the turbulence of existence so that one no longer shakes, sinks, or lashes out. That's what patience is. Patience is a tool, in a sense, a skillful means to allow us to not be caught up in all the turbulence of our mind and our life in general, I suppose. Classically, there are two problems with the lack of patience when it comes to practice in particular. The first is that we start practicing to get something, some magical experience, some special blissful feeling, like the ones you read about or someone told you about, or like you had the last time you sat. Desire has entered the scene, the cause of all your suffering. It's like, how many times have we done this? Speaking personally, you have what you think of as, quote, a good sit. You know, it's calm, it's focused. Afterwards, you just feel really clear and precise in how you're functioning in the world. And you think, I finally got it. I finally figured this stuff out. And then maybe the next time you sit, that happens again. I've really got it figured out. But then the next time you sit, it's like a train wreck. And now you think, oh, I've lost it. I thought I got it, now I've lost it. And now you've just created your own suffering over and over again, thinking that somehow, if you do things just right, that wonderful experience will arise again. But life and practice is totally random. There's no way we can make this practice into being something that brings about a certain state of mind or a certain state of body or a certain experience. It just doesn't work that way. And so basically, instead of practicing in a way to lessen your suffering, you're practicing in a way that's creating more suffering by not being just patient and seeing what happens. The second problem is that the way of practice leads to striving, which is the opposite in a sense. Too much effort. It leads to tension. Your patience is said to be the direct antidote to striving. The direct antidote to striving. It's like you can actually end up putting too much effort into the practice. Like, remember the Buddha's always talking about the middle way, some this balance between pushing too hard and not pushing at all. Somewhere in the middle, that's where we want to be. And that's where patience arises quite strongly. I'm going to read a little bit from Sharon Saul's work here, because she has things to say about this, of course. This is from her book, Loving Kindness. And she's talking about being patient in practice. Be patient with yourself in this practice, and try not to hold rigid expectations of what you should be experiencing. The key word there is should. And we get this idea that it should be a certain way. Strong expectations detract from our capacity for joy and will often lead to more anger. When we have rigid expectations, we can feel a great sense of helplessness if those expectations are not quickly met. We see our actions as being fruitless, not going anywhere, and we get lost in contempt or self-condemnation. Remember that whatever anger, fear, or sorrow arises will pass away, and we can always return to the intention to care for ourselves and for all beings. Beginning again and again is the actual practice. Beginning again and again takes patience, right? Not a problem to be overcome, so that one day we can come to the real, in quotes, meditation. So this, what we're talking about here, I had a very powerful lesson in my own personal practice around this issue. At one point in the aughts and early teens, I suppose, too, I was going to Spirit Rock every February to sit for a month. It was when I was gung-ho. Anyhow, I was so, this is about the third or fourth year I'd done this. And I was just sitting, you know, doing my, I was very diligent. I never missed a sitting practice or a walking practice. And I missed, went to all the Dharma talks, and I got up early to do extra practice. I was just one of the very key. And so I was fairly concentrated and focused and mindful. But I was just sitting in the hall like any other day I'd been there. This is fairly late on in the retreat, I suppose. And right in the middle of a sitting period, something just shifted. It's the only word I can think of that describes what happened. And it was like all of a sudden, my sense of paying attention to what's arising and being able to see the details and experience the details very precisely, it was just there. And it was like, it almost like everything was sort of tingling and sparkling. but I was, and I said, oh, this is interesting. I sat there and it stayed there. And I thought, well, you know, I was wise enough to think, well, this will come, you know, this won't last long, so I should hang out with this. And I sat there and sat there. And at some point, the bell rang for the end of the sit. And I was sitting there going, now, I'm not going to get up. I'm not going to get up, because if I get up, sure enough, this experience will go away. But eventually I said, well, I have to just have faith. So I stood up and I went to the walking hall, and it just kept that energy, that experience just continued all through a walking period. So it's like about 40 minutes of walking, you know, walking back and forth, walking practice. Then I came back, the bell rang, and I came back down into the hall and sat again. And partway through that sit, it sort of dissipated. So I'd had this experience that lasted somewhat longer than an hour. And it was like, wow, I'm thinking, very foolish me. Now I've really got it now. I mean, this is what this practice is, that experience is, this is what it's all about, right? And then a couple of days later, the retreat ended and I went home. And in my mind, it was like, I've got something different now. I figured something out. All this sitting's starting to pay off, right? And so I went back to Spirit Rock the next year. And my intention, my clear intention, was to have that experience again. I mean, that's what this practice meant, was to get that experience again, right? And once again, practicing very diligently every day and sticking with the program and getting up extra early. And I actually stopped eating the evening meal, which is one of the things you can do to get more energy. And so for almost 4 weeks, it's like, when's this going to happen? When's this going to happen? I really was like caught in wanting it to happen, and it just didn't happen at all. I was really concentrated. I was sticking with the program. I was like, there's other things going, but this experience just never wasn't there. Just wasn't there. And then, so this is the last full day, and the last full day, I was walking down the hill from where the meditation hall is to where the dining hall is for lunch. And after lunch, the last full day of a retreat like that, you get together and you do practice talking and have little discussions, and it's like your concentration gets dissipated. At least that's been had been always been my experience. So I'm walking down the hill, and this thought arises in the mind. Oh well, yeah, not gonna happen. I guess it's just not gonna happen this time. It was like I just sort of dropped into a space of paying attention to what was actually just there right now, instead of wanting this thing to happen. And literally, I'm walking, right? The next step, the whole energy arose just like that. There it was. Just stopped wanting. I was just, all I had to do was be patient. Just let things be. And there it was. And it lasted again. I ate the most amazing bowl of salad you ever saw in your life. This was lunch. And then I went for a walk and sat up on a hill and looked at, and it lasted for about an hour and a half again, and then it dissipated again. And I realized, of course, as I was contemplating afterwards, that what had prevented it from happening was my wanting, by not just being patient and letting things be. I got caught in wanting it to be a certain way. And one more interesting thing. In all my years of practice since then, this is like 15 years ago, it's never happened. Never happened again. Nothing like it. Just doesn't happen. And the thing is, that's perfectly okay. It was fascinating. It really encouraged me to understand that practice could lead to that sort of energetic experience. When I thought about it and tried to describe it to people, I said the only thing that came that I could, only thing I could compare it to is being stoned on acid, which I had some experience with in my misspent youth. But it was different than that, because with drugs, that energy was always sort of jangled, and then you always paid the price afterwards. I don't know if you've ever done that sort of thing, but after you do something like acid, for the next day, your sort of body has to recover from all the what's gone on in your body from having chemicalized it so much. And none of that was present. This was just this pure, sweet, energetic experience. Anyhow, I'm just trying to point out patience is what I needed there. Patience is what we need when we're practicing. As I mentioned, also, the flip side of this, if you're striving, which is, I was clearly striving, I'm trying to make something happen. And what can also happen when you're striving, if you're not patient, is you grow discouraged. I'm putting all this energy into things and nothing's happening. Nothing's happening. Now, I'm not getting anywhere, wherever it is I could be getting to, right? And you start to doubt the practice and your ability to do the practice. And you can quickly, this can quickly turn into sort of a downward depressive spiral, and you quit practicing completely. I've seen this happen with people. Luckily for me, it never occurred that way. I just thought, okay, I've had times when I've had to, well, I have to sort of shift my practice, but I've never actually just walked away. Is the Book of Joy. This is another idea of patience in a different sort of language. This is Bishop Desmond Tutu speaking about. This is more, I think, directed towards life in general as opposed to practice in particular, but it applies equally well to both. I mean, life is just extended practice, right? And I think it takes time to learn to be laid back. That fresh expression, be laid back. And be laid back is, in a sense, having patience, he continued. You know, it's not something that comes just ready-made for you. No one ought to feel annoyed with themselves. It just adds to the frustration. I mean, we are human beings, fallible human beings. And as the Dalai Lama points out, there was a time, I mean, we see him serene and calm, yet there were times when he too felt annoyed, and perhaps there still are. Earlier in the book, the Dalai Lama talked about in his early days getting really upset every time his flight was late or delayed. He took him a while to learn not to sort of react that way to the very vagaries of technology, right? It's like muscles that have to be exercised to be strong. Sometimes we get too angry and with ourselves, thinking that we ought to be perfect from the word go. Ah, yes. It's another part of the patience thing. We think we should be perfect, right? Somehow we can't wait to be perfect, right? But this being on earth is a time for us to learn to be good, to learn to be more loving, to learn to be more compassionate. And you learn not theoretically. The Archbishop was pointing his index fingers at his head. You learn when something happens that tests you. And then he was pretending to be speaking as God might. Hello, you said you wanted to be more compassionate. Hello, you wanted to be a little more laid back. We get very angry with ourselves. We think we ought to be supermen and superwomen from the start. The Dalai Lama's serenity didn't come fully formed. It was through the practice of prayer and meditation that the gentleness, the compassion grew, is being patient and accepting within reasonable limits. Accepting circumstances as they are, because if there are circumstances that you cannot change, then it's no use beating your head against the brick wall. That just gives you a headache. This is the veil of growth and development. So, how does patience apply more to our daily life? I mean, I keep coming back to this topic because it's so important that we take this practice and we apply it to our life in the world. And in our daily life, patience has more a sense of endurance. Being willing to put up with unpleasant things that arise in our daily lives. Because if you live in the world, sure enough, it's not all going to be, peaches and roses. Stuff's going to happen that is unpleasant. And there's that old saying, patience is a virtue. Yeah, we say, yeah. This is a virtue. It isn't viewed that way in our current culture at all. Patience is seen as a weakness, something that you have to have only if you are not in a position of strength. If you're in a position of strength, you don't need to be patient. That's the view. If you are calm and steady, if you don't react strongly to things that should upset you, then there must be something wrong with you. People will criticize you, your practice, and even your way of life. I see this a lot in the environmental movement in the world these days, where I've had people get upset with me that I'm not upset enough. It's like, wait a sec, you know, everybody has to find their own way through these things. But it's like, no, you're supposed to be really upset and angry. And you simply need to simply endure. Have patience with these people. These people that tell you that you should be upset and angry, that you shouldn't be a certain way. Maybe it's like you should be something else other than angry, even if you should be like sort of like sweetness and light all the time. Equally difficult. You just have to have patience with these people. You can't, no sense arguing with them. That just creates more unpleasantness and more suffering for both you and the other person. So you just, okay, thank you. Very interesting. Some more from Ajahn Susita. He's talking about this idea of patience in life and in practice. The Buddha overcame Mara, and sort of the evil devil-like spirit in the Buddhist world. He overcame the forces of delusion, anger, fear, aversion, and greed through practicing patience, not through blaming anyone, ignoring those forces, or running away from them. So when you're stuck in a traffic jam, anxious for resolution to a crisis, or beset with a migraine, it's good to remember that the Buddha was here too and found a way through. In an age where one is encouraged not to wait but to go faster, not to accept but to be more demanding, this parami may be the one you use most frequently to cross the floods. This section is called Acceptance Without Expectation. Patience deals with checking emotional reactions, but it's not a denial of emotional intelligence. Patience has the gut knowledge that recognizes that a problem or a pain is not something to run away from, get flustered by, or be self-pitying about. It has the wisdom to know that we have to prioritize the steps to which we can resolve suffering. It's true that it may be possible to find an alternative route to the destination. It may well be that more negotiations are needed to resolve the problem. It may be that there's a medicine that will ease the pain. The first thing to do is not to react, not to rage, despair, or mentally proliferate. Our first effort is to draw a line around the suffering, take a step back, and know that's that. Then there's the effort to recollect that we can be free of the suffering, that we can let go. We don't have to take suffering in and adopt it as the final, real, and solid. After that initial recollection, we have the encouragement to investigate and then to draw out the hook that snags our heart on the rough stuff of life. All this takes patience. Patience holds us present with the suffering in a spacious way, encouraging the mind to open. And an open mind both feels more peaceful in itself and more readily sees into the cause of the suffering. Patience is not a numbing resignation of the difficulties of life. It doesn't mean that suffering is all right. It doesn't mean shrugging things off and not looking to improve our behavior. Nor does it mean putting up with something until it goes away. The practice of patience means bearing with dukkha without the expectation that it will go away. Now, that's a really important sentence. I'm going to read it again. The practice of patience means bearing with dukkha without the expectation that it will go away. We have to go, oh, this is what I got, and that's okay. In its perfection, patience means giving up any kind of deadline, so the mind is serene and equanimous. But if the patience isn't pure yet, and it takes time to develop patience, the mind still feels pushy or defensive. Impure patience is the attitude, just hold on and eventually things will get better. I'll get my own way in the end if I'm patient enough. This approach can temporarily block or blunt the edge of suffering, but it does not deal with the resistance or the desire that is the suffering's root. Pure patience is a kind of acceptance that acknowledges the presence of something without adding anything to it or covering it up. It is supported by the insight that when one's mind stops fidgeting, whining, and blaming, then suffering can be understood. It is this suffering that stirs up hatred and greed and despair, and it is through the practice of Dhamma, or the way of liberation, that its energy and emotional current can be stopped. Reactivity isn't the truth of the mind. Another key sentence. Reactivity isn't the truth of the mind. It's a conditioned reflex. It's not self. Because of that, suffering can be undone. And when it is, the mind is free. So it's like patience is the antidote to dukkha. Continue on with Ajahn Sasita here. At the core of our suffering is the crucial point where we don't want emotional pain. Another key sentence. At the core of our suffering is the crucial point where we don't want emotional pain. Who wants emotional pain, right? Our resistance can throw us into a fit of doubt, lack of confidence, and the feeling that we are useless. In that loss of balance, the mind thrashes around and creates either a self who is the victim or a self who is to blame. But when we get right to the point, we can see that what's actually there is the wriggling in order to deflect the pain in our hearts. We blame others, we blame ourselves, the world, fate, our past karma, or some such concept. We search for scapegoats that carry all the pain. All this is the mind resisting or wriggling away from painful feeling. And in the process, the mind loses the strength and clarity that would enable it to bear it and with it and even let go of the feeling. It's the resistance to it. It's that grating. If, on the other hand, if we draw attention gently but steadily back to the source of our suffering, we find a place where we can work and assemble our skills around this pain rather than trying to find a way around it. If we go directly to the feeling itself, we can sense that the feeling has no intention. It has no aim to hurt us. It's just doing what feeling does. Feeling feels. It's not self. It has no aim, no agent, and it belongs to no one. Why not let it go its own way and keep the heart free from tangling with it? If we do that, even if the physical feeling remains, the mind can be serene. It doesn't mean that we don't act for our own or other people's welfare. We do so from a cool and wise place. In this way, we use that which is painful, embarrassing, or tedious as a tool to purify and strengthen the mind. That's another benefit of patience. It's a way to strengthen the mind, literally. There's also, however, the whole thing sound pretty grim, right? It's also a very pleasant aspect of patience in daily life. This is a thing that Thich Nhat Hanh speaks about a lot. I've seen this in books and seen him talk this way. Basically, he says, think about something, take look at something that happens in your everyday life. You're driving in your car and you come to a red light. Because you're going someplace, your mind isn't in the present moment, but in the future, planning what is going to happen when you reach your destination. This is how the mind is often operating when we're driving. I mean, when we're driving, we have to be aware at a minimal level to what's our environment, because we're driving in this thing that can cause a lot of damage if we weren't. But often what our mind is figuring, oh yeah, when I get there, I got to park there, and that's my favorite spot, and then I'm going to go into this store. And, it's like it's a way ahead of present moment. And the forced idleness of the red light will often give rise to impatience. This red light. Instead, make this pause in your busy day a chance to practice. This is Thich Nhat Hanh's famous advice. Even if it's only for 30 seconds. Patiently drop into your consciousness of your breath. Make the red light an opportunity, not an impediment. How often do we get caught waiting, whether it's for a red light, or waiting in a queue to get our groceries checked out, or waiting, don't we? People don't wait in banks, lines in banks much anymore. It used to be when we did, but now we just go to the bank machine, right? Whatever. But there's lots of times when we're waiting for something, and we can just make it like, oh God. Waiting in line in the grocery store is a great time to practice metta for all the other people who are rushing around and trying to get out of there. Just hang out with them and offer metta to them instead of feeling like, oh, I'm stuck in this line, and why is this person getting five of the same thing, and how we can get caught up in. Ever notice how other people's groceries are so stupid? What's wrong with them? You get caught in that space. It's like, oh my God, how could they possibly want that stuff? Bad for a dollar, bad food. Whatever, we just get caught in those places. Instead, just be patient. Offer the poor person doing the checkout, who's being harassed by this person, maybe, or just because they got this incredibly tedious job. Offer metta for them. Make it the time to practice metta. Oh my God, it's my wait in line metta practice. Now it's I can just be there. I don't mind being in this line anymore at all. This is patience in action in our daily lives. Here's another way to look at this. At least one more way. Taking up the practice of meditation is a lifetime commitment. Whether your lifetime is going to be another, who knows, 10 years, 50 years, who knows? We don't know how long and what time we have left. But I really think this is it's not like, well, it's a hobby and I'll try this out and then I'll go do basket weaving instead. This is like a lifetime commitment. Makes the idea of patience sensible in a way, doesn't it? Just, oh, I've got the rest of my life to figure this out and learn more and progress in this practice. It's okay not to be in a rush. And there can be long periods of time in this practice, I'm speaking from personal experience again, where it seems like nothing is happening. It's like get up and I go and I sit and do my 40 minutes and sit in the morning, and it's nice, but you go through periods like that. I mean, it's like this practice is also very cumulative. So over long periods of time, little tiny incremental changes are happening. And you don't even notice them because they're so tiny, but they accumulate. And then you look back and go, oh, yeah, I can see things have really changed. And I, once again, speaking from personal experience, I can pretty much tell you that if you practice with this, stay with this practice and stick with it and practice diligently, that's what happens. That's certainly been my experience. There is these often very long periods of time where it's like You don't go up onto those plateaus. It's just like steady. Once again, I had an experience in my own personal life that illustrates this quite well, actually. When I initially started meditating, I was actually formally initiated into a mantra practice back in 1978. And I practiced in that form for 25 years. And over those 25 years, people who I hung out with, people who are the same teacher and would go to ashrams and do those things that we did back in those days, would always want to, we're talking, all wanted to talk to me, and we wanted to compare what they were experiencing. And they always had these amazing, incredible things happening, and I was like, wow, this is great. And I would say something like, well, nah, nothing like that happens. I feel sort of calmer, and this seems to help me sort of deal with my life in the world. But nothing amazing is happening at all. It's just I practice. I keep stick with it. And they were always astounded, these people, because how could you've been doing this a long time, Gopala Krishna was my name at the time. You've been doing this for a long time, Gopala Krishna, and nothing's happening. What's going on? How can you possibly keep going? I said, well, just seems right. And I sort of had faith in the practice. Then I came to this Theravada mindfulness practice back in 2003. And because I'd done 25 years of mantra practice, I really had learned how to concentrate, how to sort of stay with something. And so when I came to this practice, I had this sort of built up concentration energy right there at my disposal. And very quickly when I came to this practice, things started happening just like that in powerful ways. And it's like, because I'd been patient, I just been patient. Oh, let's stick with this practice and see if it makes sense. I want to, Swami Vishnu says this is what I should do, so this is what I'm going to do. And my wife was practicing, and all my friends were practicing. It seemed like what I'm supposed to do, right? So I just kept at it. And it wasn't until I shifted my way of practicing that the benefit of all that serious, patient practice became really obvious. Just, oh, right, sure. And do I sometimes wish that I'd, discovered this mindfulness practice in my 20s instead of my 50s? Sure. But I have no regrets. It was like that time I spent became very useful when I came to this practice. When I first started practicing mindfulness, it was really interesting because I'd be sitting there and my mind would go a little still and my mantra would sort of self-start and I would just be saying my mantra. And no, I'm not supposed to be, I'm not supposed to be doing that anymore. I'm supposed to be paying attention to my breath. I have to sort of like steer myself in the right direction. Two more things to share. This is a section in Joseph Goldstein's book Mindfulness. I read this sentence. He's talking about equanimity, which I'll talk about in a few weeks. But he's talking about it in the context of the 10 paramis. He's saying that equanimity, besides being one of the seven factors of awakening, is also the last of the 10 paramis. And he lists the 10 paramis. And then he says this really interesting sentence. Of these, patience and equanimity are considered the mainstays for all the others. Ledi Sayadaw wrote that only when we have set ourselves up with these two can we fulfill the rest. Patience and equanimity. Equanimity being an evenness of mind, a steadiness and evenness of mind. Patience and equanimity allow all the others to blossom. You're in some sense, the foundation of this whole practice. Just an interesting thought. Of course, I have a little bit of poetry here. This is from Dana Fald's book, Going In In. Another one of my favorites. This is called The Weaver and the Loom. Sit here for a bit. Place yourself outside the frenzied pace of life. Slow down long enough to appreciate birds in flight, water drops like prisms in the grass, and countless shades of green. Step off the fast track and listen to the sound of breath and birdsong. Take a moment to just be, and in the being, know the whole of this creation, mystery and madness, passion and profanity, know it all as one stunning tapestry. Sit still, and the thin line between sacred and profane simply fades away. There's nothing then to reconcile. All the disparate threads are woven on the loom of life. Sit here for a bit, and your unique place in the pattern becomes clear. Take the still point with you when it's time to walk away. Make the choice to see affinity, to watch the picture take shape as the thread joins threads. Dare to be the weaver and the loom, creator and creation, the sower and the sown. In a moment of stillness, all that came before is seen as one. Sounds like patience in action to me.